they had put down on Marahan Road, a wide dirt road immediately east of the crash, though Wilkinson could not yet see Super 6-1. As Mogadishu neighborhoods went, this one was upscale. This wide north-south street was intersected by narrow alleys running east-west. He knew Super 6-1 was in one of those. There were one- and two-story houses made of either rose-tinted, white, or gray-brown stone, roofed with tin, most arrayed around small inner courtyards. Some of the outer walls were smooth plaster and had been painted, although all were stained with the orange sand of the streets. Most of the walls were uneven. Even the ones made of modern cinder blocks were so sloppily mortared, they resembled a hastily stacked pile of stones. It was clear that most of the construction, while in some cases ambitious, was strictly do-it-yourself. There were small trees inside the courtyards, and some out on the street. He saw some of his team across the road moving west, up a narrow alley. The kit bags and fast ropes were still in the middle of Marahan Road. Alongside was a long shard of Super 6-1's shattered rotors. At impact, pieces of the rotors had been hurled blocks away. Wilkinson ran across the road, still hearing the loud snap of bullets around him, and picked up both bags. As he rounded the corner to the alley, he saw the wreck. He was startled by its size. They were used to seeing Blackhawks in the air, or out on spacious tarmacs. In this narrow alley, it looked tragic, like a harpooned whale beached on its left side. The T-shaped tail boom was twisted and bent down. On its side like that, the bird was about 8 feet high. There were bits and pieces of rotor, engine, stone, and mortar scattered all over the top of it. Painted on the front end of the bird, under the right cockpit door facing upward, was a crude cartoon of a crooked-nosed Indian with a head feather, and the words, Sitting Bull. He remembered that Bull Briley was 6-1's co-pilot. Much had already happened. The rescue team's D-boys and rangers, including the group from Chalk 2, who had run over from the target building, had set up a small perimeter, basically guarding the alley to the front and rear of the downed aircraft. The crushed nose of the bird pointed east. There were a few dead Somalis scattered on the street. People would rush out, often women or children, to retrieve their weapons, and others would step out to pull bodies to cover. Sergeant Fales was at the front end of the wreckage, stretching up to peer inside, when he felt a tug at his left pants leg. Then came the pain. It felt like a hot poker had been stabbed through his calf muscle. Fales, a big, broad-faced man who had fought in Panama and during the Gulf War, felt anger with the pain. Here he was, after years of training for a moment like this, and after less than 3 minutes on the ground, he'd been shot. How was he to do his job, direct this rescue, with a big bloody hole in his leg? He hopped back from the front of the helicopter with a disappointed grimace. Wilkinson caught up as Fales hobbled back toward the tail of the bird. Delta Sergeant First Class Bob Mabry had him under one arm. "What's up?" Wilkinson asked. "I've been shot." "What?" "Been shot. Rat bastard shot me." Fales and Mabry ducked into the hole the crashing helicopter had knocked in the south wall of the alley. Mabry cut open his pants with his scissors and saw that the bullet had passed through the calf muscle and out the front of his leg. It had apparently not broken the leg bones. By the look of it, with flaps of muscle tissue spilled out of the wound, they figured it ought to hurt badly. But other than that stabbing pain right after he'd been shot, Fales felt nothing. The anesthetic of fear and adrenaline. Mabry stuffed the muscle tissue back into the hole, packed some gauze into it, and then applied a pressure dressing. Both men then crawled back out into the alley, finding cover in a small cup-shaped space behind the main body of the helicopter created by the bent tail boom. The injury to his partner heightened Wilkinson's sense of urgency. He had thought they'd have a few minutes to set up before the pressure came. In the past, it had usually taken 10 to 20 minutes for a Somali crowd to gather around any action on the streets. Clearly, this time was different. Speed was critical. Going in, they had been told that the main body of the assault force would be moving from the target house in vehicles to this crash site, so he expected them at any minute. They had to have the wounded and dead out of the chopper, perform any emergency medicine necessary, and place them on litters by the time the convoy approached. Now he'd lost his team leader. Wilkinson moved up to the front. A Delta sniper, Sergeant First Class James McMahon, who had been on Super 6-1 when it crashed, was already on top of the bird, pulling out Bull Briley. McMahon's face was badly cut and swollen, and had already turned black and blue. He looked like he was wearing a fright mask. Briley was obviously dead. On impact, something had sliced cleanly through his head, angling up from just under his chin. He was relatively easy to get at because he was strapped in the right seat, which was now on the high side. Wilkinson helped McMahon pull Briley up and out, and then handed his body down. McMahon climbed down into the cockpit and checked on Elvis. "He's dead," he told Wilkinson. The PJ felt the need to see for himself. He told McMahon to get some attention for his face, and then climbed up and into the bird. It was eerily quiet inside. There had been no fire, and there was no smoke. Wilkinson was surprised at how intact it all was. Everything inside that hadn't been strapped down had come to rest on the left side, which was now the bottom. Most had been thrown to the front, and was now piled up against the back of the pilot's seat. There was a slight odor of fuel inside, and there were liquids draining from places. He ran a finger into some fluid dripping down the side, smelled, and tasted it. It wasn't fuel. It was probably hydraulic fluid. Sunlight came through the wide right-side doors that now faced the sky. He observed all this suspended upside down through the right-side door. Reaching down, he checked Wolcott's neck for a pulse. He was dead. Both pilots had taken the brunt of the impact, and Wolcott, because his side had hit the ground, had gotten the worst of it. The whole front end of the helicopter had folded in on him from the waist down. He was still in his seat. His head and upper torso were intact, but the rest of him was wedged tightly under the instrument panel. Wilkinson tried to slide his hand between the panel and the pilot's legs, but there was no space above or below. He could not be lifted or pulled free. Wilkinson then slid completely into the helicopter and crawled behind the pilot's seat to see if it could be pulled back or reclined, so he could slide Wolcott out that way. But that vantage looked no better. He then climbed out and got down on the dirt by the smashed left underside of the cockpit, digging to see if there was a chance of creating an opening underneath the wreck, out of which Elvis's body could be extracted. But all the tonnage of the Black Hawk had plowed hard into the soil. There was going to be no easy way to get him out. Chapter 3 Shortly before the other Rangers came down ropes to the crashed helicopter, Abdiaziz Ali Aden had darted out from under the green Volkswagen. The slender Somali teenager, with the head of thick bushy hair, had seen the helicopter clip the roof of his house before falling into the alley. He had helped his family to safety, and then returned to protect the house from looters, only to find himself in the middle of a gunfight. He saw one of the Americans who roped down pick up an M-16 from a man he had just shot. As the soldier came toward him, Aden panicked. He slid out from under the car and ran back into his house, slamming the door shut. He ran to a small storage room in the front that had two windows, one that faced out over the alleyway where the helicopter lay, the other that looked out at Marahan Road, where more Rangers were descending. The intersection and alley then swarmed with American soldiers, and the shooting was loud, constant, and accelerating. The walls of his house were built of heavy stone, so he had a safe ringside seat. Aden watched the American soldiers climb hurriedly in and out of the wrecked helicopter. They pulled the pilot out and carried him to the tail end of it. The pilot had a deep and terrible cut across his face, and he looked eerily white and was clearly dead. Two of the Rangers placed a big gun on top of the Fiat across the street, which struck Aidan as funny. It turned the little car into a kind of technical. Another of the soldiers crawled right into the trash hole. Aidan's family and their neighbors disposed of trash by digging holes or ditches in the street outside their house and filling it with their dumpings. When it was full, they burned it. This soldier just dug himself into the trash. Only his head and rifle stuck out from the debris. He was shooting steadily. Chapter 4 Sergeant First Class Al Lamb was grateful for the hole. He didn't care what was in it. They were taking fire from all directions, and there wasn't much to hide behind. Sammies were sticking their AK-47s down over the top of the walls. Lamb had gone to the end of the alley at the front of the chopper, with a Delta operator, Ranger Sergeant Mark Belda, and eager young specialist Rob Phipps. Phipps had roped down to the street with specialist John Bellman, and the two had immediately knocked in a door to get off the street. They barged in on a woman in a turban and scarlet checkered robe, who was missing a front tooth. She screamed. Phipps saw five or six small children hiding under a bed. The woman dropped to her knees and put her hands up, begging them with words they didn't understand. The Rangers backed out the door and then ran down to the alley, where they saw the tail of the helicopter. Standing there was Sergeant McMahon, who just shouted at them through his swollen, bruised face, "The 12! The 12!" meaning they needed more covering fire at the 12 o'clock position. Phipps took a spot by the stone wall the chopper had fallen against. There was a small intersection about 20 feet ahead where another sandy alley crossed. On the opposite two corners were stone walls, and behind them clumps of trees. Directly behind him, jutting up from under the wreck and growing halfway to the corner, was a big cactus bush. That and the downed chopper hid his position from anyone behind him. He stayed back from the corner, so that he didn't present a target from the alley in front of him. At first, he was there by himself. He got jumpy, so he called Sergeant Lamb on his handheld radio and asked for help. Then, Staff Sergeant Stephen Lycopolis moved up and crouched on the other side of the alley, just past the hole the Blackhawk had knocked in the south wall. His rear was protected by the heap of stone and mortar from the pulverized concrete. They were mainly looking to pick off gunmen to the east, who were sending a steady flow of rounds up the alley, and to prevent any Sammies from approaching the crash from that direction. It didn't take long for one to try. A man in a loose white cotton shirt, baggy pants, and sandals came creeping up the alley right toward them with an AK, walking at a crouch with the weapon held forward. Phipps shot him, and he fell sideways into the alley. Then another man ran out to retrieve the gun. Phipps shot him. Then another man ran out. Phipps shot him, too. Then Lamb, Belda, and Specialist Greg Gould moved up to join Phipps and Lycopolis. Belda joined Phipps on his side of the alley. Gould went over by Lycopolis, and Lamb dug into the hole. The Chalk Two Rangers, who had been first to arrive, had the 6 o'clock position covered. They'd fanned out to take all four corners of the big intersection west of the crash. The five men at the 12 o'clock spot dug in as best they could, covering the smaller intersection to the east. They stayed close to the helicopter. Lamb felt that moving his men across the intersection might break down the perimeter and risk getting them cut off. It appeared as though many of the shots coming their way were from a clump of trees about 20 yards over, behind a high wall at the southeast corner across the intersection. Rounds were chipping stone and earth around Phipps, and he could hear them puncturing the Blackhawk's thin metal hull. Lycopolis and Gould were closest to the wall, and at Lamb's direction they began throwing their grenades over it. One by one they exploded, but the shooting continued, so Belda shot up the trees with his saw, while Phipps tossed his own grenades to Lycopolis. The staff sergeant threw them, and these too exploded, again without effect. So Belda tossed Lycopolis his grenades. The staff sergeant threw the first, which exploded, and then tossed the second. This time, there was no blast. Instead, seconds later, what looked to be the same grenade came flying back over the high wall at them. Either Lycopolis had not removed the safety strap on the last grenade he threw, or that one had been a dud, and the Somalis behind the wall had an American grenade of their own. Phipps dove forward as several voices shouted, "Grenade!" The blast was like a gut punch. It just sucked all the air out of him. He felt like he was on fire, and his ears rang from the blast, and his nose and mouth were filled with a bitter, stabbing, metallic taste. When the initial ball of fire was gone, he still felt terrible burning on both legs and on his back. The explosion had clobbered him. His face was blackened and beginning to swell, and his eyes were puffing shut. As Phipps regained his senses, he lifted his head and looked back over his shoulder. Gould had also been hit and was bleeding from the buttocks. A Somali had run into the roadway and picked up the AK from the pile of dead and wounded where he had been shooting earlier. The man was taking aim when one of the D-boys back by the hole in the wall dropped him with a quick burst. The man's head just popped apart. The operator waved at Phipps, shouting, "Come on! Come on!" Phipps tried to stand, but his left leg gave out. He tried again, and fell again. "Come on!" shouted the D-boy. Phipps crawled. The burning sensation was fierce now, and his left leg wasn't working right. When he got close enough, the D-boy grabbed his face and pulled him the rest of the way in. Phipps was panicked. "Holy shit! I'm hit! I got shot! I got shot!" "You're all right," the D-boy reassured him. "You'll be all right." He tore open his pants and applied a field dressing. The wind was out of young Phipps's sails. He was out of the fight. Chapter 5. Across the city, about a mile southwest, Black Hawk pilots Mike Goffina and Jim Yacone circled over Durant's wrecked bird worriedly. The men in Super 6-4 had been lucky. Most of this part of the city consisted of stone houses, hard structures, but the spot where Durant and his co-pilot Ray Frank had gone down was just rag shacks and tin huts, nothing hard enough to flip the chopper over. The bird was built with shock absorbers to withstand a terrifically hard impact, so long as it landed in an upright position, which the Black Hawk had. In other ways, they were less lucky. The CSAR team had already fast-roped in at Walcott's crash site. No one had anticipated two choppers going down. Durant and his co-pilot Ray Frank and their crew would have to be rescued by ground forces, which meant there was going to be a dangerous wait. Watching now from above, Goffina and Yacone could already see Somalis spilling into alleyways and footpaths, homing in on the downed helicopter. A company of the QRF, 2nd Battalion, 14th Infantry, 10th Mountain Division, had been summoned to help. Under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Bill David, 150 soldiers on 9 deuce-and-a-half trucks and a dozen Humvees were making their way toward the Ranger base by a roundabout route that took them out of the city. Nobody was sure exactly how to find Durant's crash site. They could see it all too clearly on the screens in the JOC, but the picture couldn't tell them exactly where the downed chopper was. Instead of just waiting for the QRF to arrive, Garrison ordered up another emergency convoy with whatever force could be assembled at the base. Leading it out would be the Rangers and D-boys who had evacuated Private Blackburn, and joining them would be dozens of support personnel, armorers, cooks, ammo handlers, and communications specialists, including an Air Force air traffic controller who volunteered to join the fight. Even as this emergency convoy was leaving the base, it was apparent to the pilots over Durant's crash site that help would not come fast enough for the downed crew of Super 6-4. They were minutes from being overrun by a violent, angry Somali mob. Trying to hold the crowds back were two Little Birds and Goffina's Black Hawk, Super 6-2. In addition to the two crew chiefs on 6-2, there were three D-boys, snipers Sergeant First Class Randy Shughart, Master Sergeant Gary Gordon, and Sergeant First Class Brad Hollings. With Sammy closing in, the Delta operators told the pilots they could be more effective on the ground. They might be able to hold off the mob until help arrived. Gofina requested permission to insert them.
"Hey, wait! We don't even know if anybody's alive yet," answered Colonel Matthews, the air commander sitting alongside Harrell in the C-2 bird.
Hearing nothing from the crew on the radio, Gofina made a low pass and caught a glimpse of Durant sitting in the cockpit, pushing at a piece of tin roof that had caved in around his legs. So he was alive. Yacon saw Ray Frank moving. Gofina flew low enough to catch the frustrated look on his friend's face. Frank had been in a tail rotor crash just like this one several years before on a training mission. A number of men in that aircraft had been killed. Frank had broken his leg and crunched his vertebrae. He had been involved in a drawn-out legal battle over it ever since. To Gofina, the look on his friend's face said, "Shit, I can't believe this happened to me again." In the back of the aircraft, they discerned some movement, which meant either Bill Cleveland or Tommy Field had survived, perhaps both. Gofina informed Matthews that there were survivors. The colonel told him to hold on. So Shughart, Gordon, Hollings, and the crew chiefs of Super 6-2 did what they could from the air. There were plenty of targets. The RPG gunners especially, it seemed, had been emboldened by success. When Gofina flared the Black Hawk in low, the wash from his rotors would literally blow thickening crowds back. As the crowd retreated, they exposed those with RPG tubes, who seemed determined to hold their ground. This made them easy targets for the snipers. Trouble was, once the snipers dropped them, others would dart out and pick up their weapons. Gofina also noticed that every time he dropped low now, he was drawing more fire himself. He and Yacon heard the tick of bullets puncturing the metal walls of the airframe. Now and then they saw a glowing arc out ahead, where rounds would clip their rotor blades and spark, tracing a bright line out in front of the cockpit. Gofina began flying faster and tried to keep to the south side of the crash site, where the fire didn't seem to be as heavy. But this was hazardous, too. He knew that immediately to the south was a neighborhood called Villa Somalia, which was known to have a sizable IDed militia. They worked the radio, urging immediate help.
Alpha 5-1, Matthews. This is Super 6-2,
Yacon.
We're going to need more friendlies to secure crash site number 2.
They were repeatedly assured that rescue was imminent. One of the Little Bird pilots reported,
"We've got to get some ground folks down here, or we're not going to be able to keep them off. There are not enough people left on board the aircraft to do it."
"Roger. Stand by. We're working on it."
"Okay, listen, this is Adams 6-4,
Garrison.
We've got a small Ranger element departing here in just a minute, headed for the second crash site. Someone needs to vector him in."
Chapter 6 Dale Sizemore had been going nuts listening to the radio. These were his brothers, his Ranger buddies out there pinned down, and they were getting hammered. He heard screams of pain and fear in the voices of hardened men. This was the big fight they'd all been preparing for all these years, and here he was, pacing around the radio with a fucking cast on his arm. Some days earlier, Sizemore had banged his elbow goofing off in the hangar. The task force officers had challenged all the NCOs to a volleyball match. But before the contest, the lower ranks had ambushed their commanders and bound them to stretchers with flex cuffs and duct tape. They then carried them out to the volleyball court and poured water on them and humiliated them in various ways. Not all the brass had gone quietly. Ranger Commander Steele had put up the fight you'd expect from a former lineman on Georgia's national championship football team, and several of the Delta officers were even harder to take down. Sizemore was the first guy to hit Harrell, the Delta lieutenant colonel, and it had been like hitting a cliff. Sizemore was a thickly muscled kid, with legs like pilings, and he'd been a decent wrestler in high school, but Harrell just tossed him to the concrete like a flyweight.
The fall dinged his elbow pretty good, but Sizemore hadn't given it a second thought. He and five other rangers finally got Harold tied down. The next day, in a chopper on a signature flight over the city, Sizemore had brushed the elbow on something again and noticed it was tender and had gotten pretty big. He woke up on his cot under the bug net early Friday morning, 2 days before the raid, to find his elbow so swollen and painful he couldn't sleep. He swallowed 4 Motrins and dozed the rest of the night, sitting up. At dawn, he was flown up to the hospital at the old U.S. Embassy, where they pronounced cellulitis and bursitis, and made a 4-inch incision to drain the joint. Then they stitched him back up, slapped a cast around it, and put him on an IV antibiotic drip, and told him he would be flying home to Fort Benning on Monday. Sizemore was crushed. He had sat alone on the hospital bed, looking out the window at another bright African morning, amazed at how much he would miss this place. This was Sizemore's first real combat zone, and he loved it. The big blonde saw gunner from Illinois had both the Ranger tab and scroll tattooed on his bulging left deltoid. His buddies were his family. And the hangar? Man, life in the hangar was a blast. They still had daily PT, physical training, and had to pull guard duty and other shit details. But ever since they hit Mog, not even regular Army Mickey Mouse could fill the available time. They played endless volleyball. An empty storage room with concrete walls and a high ceiling turned out to be a perfect ping-pong arena. The Romanians would come over and make the ball dipsy-doodle like it had an IQ. There was a running game of gin rummy. Wily little Private Othick had accumulated a pile of winnings, and long sessions of board games like Risk, Scrabble, and Stratego. When they weren't training, or on some other detail, guys passed time reading books, playing Game Boy, watching videotapes, writing home, or just hanging out. Sizemore liked to retreat to a hallway out behind the main hangar where there was a steady ocean breeze, clap on headphones, and just zone out for an hour now and then. Then there was the beach. Even though the ocean had sharks, a beach was a beach. With sand and dust everywhere, and showers rationed every few days, beach mode more or less prevailed, at least compared to the usual ranger standards. To anybody but rangers, the accommodations were austere. Each man had only about a 4-by-8-foot rectangle of space to call his own. An informal protocol had developed about that space. Guys would ask permission before stepping in or walking across. Each cot had thin wooden poles sticking up from the corners, from which, during the night, they could drape the netting to keep out Somalia's ferocious mosquitoes. The hangar itself was filthy. It had that musky third-world odor to it. The tarmac, with all the choppers, was right outside the big open front doors, so the steady salt-air breeze that came through was scented sweetly with jet fuel and oil. Guys had to keep their weapons wrapped to ward off the fine dust and sand that accumulated on everything. The roof leaked in about a dozen spots. There were massive gaps here and there in the tin walls, so when it rained, water poured in from all directions. Some of the units sandbagged off their space to keep the floodwaters at bay, which broke up the cavernous space into warrens that had a more homey feel. The Air Force guys had built themselves a nifty clubhouse-like enclosure toward the back. Before the rear wall was a big American flag draped from the rafters, alongside a homemade poster showing their 3rd Battalion, 75th Regiment crest. The chopper crews were just inside the front door. The D-boys had the corner of the hangar off to the left as you entered, and the rest were Rangers, Sizemore's buddies. His bunk was right in the middle toward the back. He could prop his boots on his rucksack and watch the rats scurry along the intricate interlace of rafters overhead, or watch the hawks who were raising chicks in a tree outside swoop in and nail pigeons in mid-flight. And what could be cooler than living with the Delta operators, the dreaded D? They were the pros, totally squared away. On the 18-hour flight aboard the giant C-141 Starlifter, when the Air Force blue shirts insisted that they all stay in their seats, the D-boys just blew them off. Right after takeoff, they unrolled thermal pads. The shiny metal floor of the bird turns ice cold at altitude. And insulated ponchos, stuck earplugs in their ears, donned eye patches, swallowed blue bombers, halcyon tablets, and racked out. They taught little tricks like wrapping tape around the pins of their grenades to make sure none accidentally snagged and pulled on a piece of equipment. They wore knee pads when they went into a fight, which made it easy to quickly drop and shoot and stay there for hours if necessary. If it was hot, they didn't walk around in full battle gear. They wore T-shirts or no shirts at all, and shorts and flip-flops. They all had sunglasses. If they'd been up until all hours, they slept in a little in the morning. When they went out on a mission, they took the weapons they thought they'd need and left behind the stuff they didn't. With the D-boys, all of whom were ranked Sergeant First Class or higher, rank meant nothing. They all, officers and non-coms, called each other by their first names or nicknames. They were trained to think and act for themselves. Nothing was done by the book for its own sake. They were guided by their own experience. They knew their weapons and tactics and business better than anyone, and basically ran their own lives, which was an extraordinary thing in the U.S. Army. Some of the operators, like blonde Norm Hooton, or short stocky Earl Fillmore, or the massively built Paul Howe, held training sessions with them, imparting the finer points of death dealing and mayhem. Hooton showed specialist Dave Deemer how to better shoot his modified saw from the hip, and got one of the Delta armorers to fit out a custom grip for him. They supplied some of the guys custom-made black canvas bags to slip over a saw, which kept the drum of the grenade launcher from getting knocked off when descending the rope, as often happened. Useful things. Fillmore, who was one of the youngest of the operators at 28, showed them how it was possible to knock a guy unconscious by delivering a hard kick to the thigh, shocking the femoral artery. Howe showed them techniques for using cover in urban terrain and how to take down a room. It was great. Delta operator Dan Bush had been a ranger just a few years back, before he'd vanished into the deeply covert. Some of the guys had known him before. Bush had changed a lot. He was Dan now, for one thing, not Sergeant Bush. A few of the guys in Bravo Company had known him as a hellraiser. Bush had always been up to something fun. He'd surfaced here in Mog a changed man. The wild man was now quietly religious and real mellow, a totally different person. He spent a lot of time back on his cot, just quietly cleaning his weapons and whipping all comers at Scrabble. Some were legendary soldiers, like the easygoing veteran Tim Martin, who had a quick dry wit, a big red blotch birthmark on his face, and a nickname, Grizz, that fit. Grizz was over 40 and had fought in nearly every conflict, open and secret, since Vietnam. He had been in the Army for more than 20 years. Nothing fooled or fazed him. He had a wife and 3 daughters at home and talked about his plans of retiring the following year and starting up a business. But the coolest of all was Mace, John Maceahunas, a cheerful, unpretentious former ranger with a bright blonde flat top and a leathery tan that made him look like a surfer. Mace wasn't as burly as the other guys, but his physique redefined the concept of being in shape. He had so little body fat and was so buff that he looked like a walking atlas of male musculature. In contrast to the easygoing Grizz, Mace's engine throttle was stuck in high gear. He worked out so much, doing push-ups, sit-ups, leg lifts, chin-ups, and tormenting himself in ways of his own devising, that the Rangers regarded him as some sort of mutant strain. Even the other D-boys held Mace in awe. He was said to be absolutely fearless. The Rangers had never had a chance to be around these guys before, even though they'd trained together once or twice. It was like an ongoing tutorial on soldiering from the best in the business. The worst thing about hangar life, of course, was no women. There were women around, but they were all nurses who worked in a different part of the base, or over at the UN compound, and all were strictly off-limits. It was tough. There was plenty of porn around, of course, and many of the Rangers were humorously casual about masturbation. Most were discreet about it, but some had adopted a sort of crude defiance, standing up next to their cot to announce, "I'm going to the porta-pot to fucking jack off." Specialist John Collette, a sawgunner with absolutely no shame about such matters, would brag about his repertory, describing innovative new onanistic techniques. "Man, you should have seen me last night. I shit you not. I was gasping." And coming up with new and unusual places to jack off. Collette claimed to have gotten a harness jack. That is, to have masturbated hanging from a parachute harness. It was pitiful. One of the Air Force PJs got a blow-up love doll in the mail, and almost nobody laughed. All this horniness under pressure produced even more adolescent silliness than usual. Corporal Jim Cavaco walked around one night with a length of nylon cord tied around the end of his penis, holding the rope up delicately between two fingers, telling everybody, "Just taking the dog out for a walk." They played a lot of Risk, the board game where color-coded armies vied to conquer the world. It took hours, so it was great for killing time. Private First Class Jeff Young, a tall, fair-haired RTO, radio telephone operator, from upstate New York, with big glasses perched on a nose too small for his long face, had grown up playing Risk with his five brothers, and was so good at it that the other guys formed coalitions to knock him out first. Young and his sergeant, Mike Goodale, had borrowed the game from the D-Boys early on, and monopolized it so much, the Delta Squadron had to have another game shipped over. Young and Goodale set it up in front of their racks, and there was usually the same bunch of guys stooped around it. Over the board, privates and sergeants and even officers all forgot about rank. They'd be teasing each other, yelling at each other, just like a regular bunch of guys. Even the nightly mortar attack was kind of a joke. The skinnies would lob rounds into the fenced-off compound that landed with a loud crump, like something very large falling on a big hollow stack of tin. It freaked guys out at first. They'd drop or dive for cover. But the skinnies had such lousy aim that they rarely hit anything, and after a while, guys would just drop and cheer when one landed. Somebody, probably it was Dom Pilla, discovered that by lifting the big door to the soda and water cooler, and then just letting it fall, it made a crump just like a mortar round. He sent guys diving once or twice before everybody wised up. Pretty soon, when they heard the sound, guys didn't even bother to drop. They'd cheer. One night, a mortar hit so close, Sizemore could see sparks from the shrapnel hitting the outer wall of the hangar. Everybody just clapped and hooted. Across the road, spooked Air Force medical personnel, not exactly hardened battle types, were holding hands and singing prayer songs, while the crazy hoo-ahs across the road were cheering like mad. The boys in the hangar had even started a pool. For a buck, you could pick a 10-minute time slot, and if a mortar round fell in your slot, you took the pool. So after everybody cheered, they would run to check the sheet to see who'd won. Nobody had figured out what they'd do with the pot if the mortar happened to fall on the winner. The movie room had three TVs and three VCRs. Guys always crowded in to watch CNN. Sometimes their own missions were featured. In fact, when the force got back from their first mission with their flex-cuffed Somali prisoners, before they had even finished stripping off their gear, they were astonished to see themselves on their top-secret mission on CNN, with footage shot from a distance by infrared cameras. Nobody ever answered the reporters' questions, and they would laugh and groan about how outrageously wrong they got everything in the newspapers and on TV. There were two armed forces radio stations, one that played almost all country music, and one that divided its playtime between white music, mostly classic rock, and black music, mostly rap. The Rangers, who, unlike the 10th Mountain Division guys based across the city, were nearly all white, would get a kick out of the dedications during black time.
Yo, my brothers and sisters, this is 2G Smoothie for you, flipping out a disc for Regina at the 271st Supply from Dope Gangsta at the 33rd. Peace.
In the evening, they practically wore out the collection of videotapes shipped over in boxes, mostly old heroic action-adventure type stuff. 1 week, they had a James Bond film festival, a different feature every night. One of the few new releases was Last of the Mohicans, which some of the guys had just finished watching twice in a row one night when Captain Steele came in, saw the final credits, and announced he hadn't seen that one yet. So they rewound it and watched it a third time. Most days, when there wasn't a mission, they trained, which was totally cool. They got to go north of the city into the desert and blow things up, or practice lobbing grenades and rockets at targets, or perfecting their marksmanship with various automatic weapons. In the dunes outside Mog, there were lots of toys and more ammo than usual to go around, and they didn't have all the range restrictions that applied back home. Out there under the hot sun in their desert fatigues, with their floppy camouflage sun hats on, they were like a bunch of overgrown kids playing soldier, with real bullets and grenades. It was the sort of thing that made rangering so cool. It was real soldiering. Hardcore. Heavy metal. It was way more fun than college. They were on an adventure. Sizemore and the rest of the guys bunked in that hangar. They were in Africa, not behind some desk or cash register, or sitting in class staring out the window across a sleepy campus. They did things like jump out of airplanes, fast rope out of helicopters, rappel down cliffs. Stuff like what they were doing over here, doing good, chasing around an exotic third world capital after a murderous warlord. Sizemore had talked the doctor into letting him return to the hangar to spend his last day with his unit, and had just been packing his stuff up at the hospital for the chopper ride back, when two men were brought in who had just been wounded in a Humvee in the city by a remote-controlled mine. There was a 10th Mountain Division guy who was all right, and a Somali-American interpreter who had been torn in half. From the waist down, he was gone. His insides were laying next to him on the gurney. Sizemore had never seen such a thing. One of the man's arms just twisted off the side of the stretcher, swinging, attached to the trunk by a hunk of meat. Who were these people? What made them think they could get away with this? When he returned to the hangar, guys were suiting up for this mission. Sizemore had seethed with frustration and disappointment. All the guys were saying this might be a hot one. What if they were right? Had he come this far to miss out on it? In his place, they were sending Specialist Stebbins, the company's training room clerk. Stebbins! Sizemore couldn't believe his luck. The hangar had buzzed with jitters. Even Sergeant Lorenzo Ruiz, the boxer, was uneasy. Nothing usually bothered Lowe. "I got a bad feeling, Dale," he said. Ruiz and Sizemore were tight. They had absolutely nothing in common, but for some reason they'd hit it off years back. Ruiz was a tough kid from El Paso, Texas, a former amateur boxer who had joined the army after a judge had given him a choice between the military or prison. In the Ranger Regiment, Ruiz had pulled his life together and excelled. He was married and had a little girl. Sizemore was just a big suburban kid, something of a ladies' man. His buddies had nicknamed him, with his full lips and big blue eyes and broad shoulders, Adonis. But Ruiz was the real romantic. Out drinking with the guys, his temper would flash 1 minute, and the next minute he'd be wiping away a tear, sniffling with his Mexican accent, "I love you guys." Ruiz was superstitious and had struggled with premonitions of his death in Somalia. Sizemore wasn't superstitious at all, but he'd made a pact with his buddy to humor him. They would both write final letters to their families that were only to be mailed if they were killed. They had exchanged them for safekeeping. Sizemore's was addressed to his mom and stepfather and aunt, and mostly just told them how much he loved them. Ruiz's told his wife he loved her and instructed his brother, Jorges, to care for their mother and grandmother.
Both wrote that if they had been killed, they had died doing what they wanted to do. There was no need to say much more. That afternoon, as Ruiz kitted up for the mission to the Black Sea, he had reminded Sizemore about the letter. "Shut up, Lowe," he told him. "You'll be back in here in a few minutes." But now, Ruiz was out there with the rest of the guys catching hell. Sizemore didn't know it, but his buddy had already been mortally wounded. Sizemore wondered where Ruiz was and how Goodell and Nelson were making out. He worried about Stebbins. Jesus, Stebby was the guy who made coffee for them. Here he was, probably the best man with a saw in the unit, and the company clerk was out there fighting his battle. Sizemore was glued to the radio outside the JOC with some other guys who had been left behind, because they had gone out on a water run shortly before the mission came up. This group had their Humvees parked in a semicircle outside the big open front doors to the hangar, ready to roll if needed. Listening to the sounds on the radio had a different effect on Specialist Steve Anderson. It scared him. Anderson had wanted to be a soldier so bad that he had lied about having severe asthma when he joined. He carried his inhaler with him everywhere. On the first day of basic training, they were all warned sternly that any drugs were contraband, and if caught with any, they were in deep, dark shit. A box was passed around the barracks, and they were told they had one last chance, an amnesty, to chuck anything they weren't supposed to have. Anderson panicked and threw in his inhaler, and then suffered such a terrible asthma attack 3 or 4 days later that he had to confess and was shipped out to a hospital. The next day, the drill sergeant told Sizemore and the rest of the guys in the platoon that Anderson had died. A month later, at airborne school, Sizemore spotted this tall, skinny ghost doing KP duty, walked over, and rubbed his eyes for a better look. Anderson had not only survived the asthma attack, somebody in the chain of command had admired his determination enough to let him stay in and keep his inhaler. But now, faced with the prospect of such pitched battle, Anderson was infected by the panic on the radio. Everybody was talking twice as much as usual, as if they needed to stay in touch, as if the radio was a net to prevent their free fall. Anderson didn't show it, but he was quaking. His stomach churned, and he was in a cold sweat. Do I have to go out there? Until this mission, nobody had gotten seriously hurt. The missions were a gas. When the megaphone sounded, "Get it on!" he had always felt cool, action, just like all the other guys. Not now. The horror hit home when Sergeant Strucker's 3 Humvee convoy had raced in, all shot up, and the docks lifted out the broken body of Private Blackburn, the ranger who had fallen from the helicopter to the street. Specialist Brad Thomas emerged from one of the Humvees with red eyes. He saw Anderson and choked out, "Pilla's dead." Thomas was crying, and Anderson felt himself start to cry. The fear was palpable. Anderson was glad to be someplace safe. He was ashamed of himself, but that's how he felt. He wasn't alone. Moments after they unloaded Pilla and Blackburn, they got orders to go back out. A second Black Hawk, Durant's, had crashed and was in danger of being overrun. Over the radio, they learned that Casey Joyce, another of their buddies, was dead. Mace and the SEALs who had helped bring Blackburn back were already rearmed and ready. Anderson saw no hesitation whatsoever with these guys, but the younger Rangers, to a man, seemed shaken. Brad Thomas couldn't believe it. He had been on the beach with Joyce and Pilla when they were called for this mission. Within the Ranger Company, Thomas, Joyce, Pilla, Nelson, and a few other guys hung together. They were a few years older and had had a little more experience. Joyce and Thomas were both married. Thomas had gone to college for a few years, studying classical guitar before enlisting. They were less boisterous, and when it came to taking risks, still willing, but less eager. Thomas had seen his friend Pilla killed, and had felt through the rest of that insane ride back to the base that he wasn't going to make it. When they arrived, he had felt an enormous sense of relief. He figured the mission was over. Things had gone completely to shit,
and the rest of the guys would be rolling back in any minute. Emotionally for him, the fight was done. So when Strucker approached and instructed the men to start rearming, they were going back out, Thomas was incredulous. How could they go back out into that? They barely escaped with their lives. The whole fucking city was trying to kill them. Strucker felt his own heart sink. His vehicles were all shot up. The rear of his Humvee was splattered with Pilla's blood and brains. When the body was pulled out, it didn't even look like Pilla anymore. The top of his head was gone, and his face was grotesquely swollen and disfigured. Strucker's men were freaking out. Mace, the grim Delta warrior, pulled Strucker aside. "Look, Sergeant, you need to clean your vehicle up. If you don't, your guys are going to get more messed up." So Strucker strode over to his squad. "Listen, men, you don't have to do this if you don't want to. I'll do it myself if I have to. But we have to clean this thing up right now, because we're fixing to roll right back out. Everybody else go resupply. Go get yourselves some more ammunition." Strucker asked his 50 gunner, "Will you help me clean up? You don't have to." Together, they set off for buckets of water. And working with sponges, they soaked up the blood and brain and scraped it from the interior. Sizemore saw all this, and it made him wild with anger. "I'm going out there with you guys," he said. "You can't. You're hurt," said Sergeant Rawley Cash, who had been in charge of the squad that had gone on the water run. Sizemore didn't argue. He was wearing gym shorts and a T-shirt, and his own gear had been packed away for the flight home tomorrow. So he ran into the hangar, pulled on his pants and shirt, and grabbed any stray gear he could find. He found a flak vest that was three sizes too big for him, and a helmet that lolled around on his head like a salad bowl. He grabbed his saw and stuffed ammo in his pockets and pouches and came running back out to the convoy with his boots unlaced and his shirt unbuttoned and just climbed into Cash's Humvee. "I'm going out," he told Cash. "You can't go out there with that cast on your elbow." "Then I'll lose it." Sizemore ran back into the hangar and found a pair of scissors. He cut straight up the inside seam of the cast and then flung it away. Then he came back and resumed his place on the vehicle. Cash just shook his head. Anderson admired Sizemore's eagerness and felt all the more ashamed of himself. He had donned his own gear as instructed, but he was mortified. He didn't know whether to feel more ashamed of his fear or his sheep-like acceptance of the orders. When it came time to climb in the vehicles, he again followed orders, amazed at his own passivity. He would go out into Mogadishu and risk his life. But it wasn't out of passion or solidarity or patriotism. It was because he didn't dare refuse. He showed none of this. Not everyone was as passive. Brad Thomas pulled Strucker aside. "Man, you know, I really don't want to go back out." The sergeant had been expecting this to happen and dreading it. He knew how he felt about driving back into the city. It was a nightmare. Thomas's words expressed how everyone felt. How could he force those men back out into the fight, especially the men who had just come through hell to get back to base? The sergeant knew all the men were watching to see how he'd handle it. Strucker was a model ranger, strong, unassuming, obedient, tough, and strictly by the book. He was like the prize pupil in class. The officers loved him, which meant at least some of the men regarded him with a slightly jaundiced eye. Challenged like this, they expected Strucker to explode. Instead, he pulled Thomas aside and spoke to him quietly, man to man. He tried to calm him, but Thomas was calm. As Strucker saw it, the man had just decided he'd taken all he could take. Thomas had just been married a few months before. He had never been one of the chest beaters in the regiment. It was a perfectly rational decision. He did not want to go back out there to die. The whole city was shooting at them. How far could they get? However steep a price the man would pay for backing down like that, and for a ranger it would be a steep price indeed. To Strucker, it looked like Thomas had made up his mind. "Listen," Strucker said, "I understand how you feel. I'm married too. Don't think of yourself as a coward. I know you're scared. I'm scared shitless. I've never been in a situation like this either, but we've got to go. It's our job. The difference between being a coward and hero is not whether you're scared. It's what you do while you're scared. Thomas didn't seem to like the answer. He walked away. As they were about to pull out, though, Strucker noticed that he'd climbed on board with the rest of the men. Chapter 7
"You're going to go ahead and lead us out," Lieutenant Larry Moore had instructed Strucker. "We're going to take these 3 5-tons, your 2 vehicles in front, my 2 in the rear. The crash site is somewhere in this vicinity," he said, pointing to a location between the K-4 traffic circle and the target building. "We don't know for sure. You're going to flip to this channel," showing him the frequency on his radio. "And we have aircraft up in the sky, and the pilot is going to tell you where to go."
"Okay, whatever," said Strucker.
One of the company clerks, Sergeant Mark Warner, stepped up. "Sergeant, can I go out?"
"You have a weapon and some ammo?"
"Yeah."
"Go ahead. Get in the back seat."
Other volunteers were piling on vehicles down the convoy. Specialist Peter Squeglia, the company armorer, had pulled on fighting gear and climbed into a truck. He had injured his ankle playing rugby in the sand with some guys from New Zealand a few days before and had been relegated to guard duty at the hangar. There was no way he could use a sore ankle as an excuse to stay out of this. So now he sat with his M16 pointed out the passenger side window of a 5-ton truck, wondering what he had gotten himself into. You joined the Army and volunteered for the Rangers, ostensibly because you were willing to go into combat. But in this day and age, you didn't really expect them to call your bluff. Squeglia considered himself more realistic about battle than most of his Ranger buddies, even though he had never gotten close to one. He had been put off by some of the bravado he'd seen in the previous weeks. He would caution his friends. "This is real stuff. One of us is probably going to get killed one of these times out." And they all laughed at him. Well, now at least one of them had definitely been killed. He'd seen them unload Pilla's body. And here he was in the thick of it. Here it was, a Sunday afternoon in early fall, the kind of day back home where he and his buddies would spend the afternoon watching football on TV and then head out to the bars of Newport, Rhode Island, trying to pick up girls. And here he was, smart guy, 25-year-old Peter Squeglia, riding shotgun in a truck out into the streets of Mogadishu, with what appeared to be the entire indigenous population trying to kill him. He felt the truck start to move. As Strucker steered out the east gate, he waited for guidance from the C-2 Blackhawk above. "You need to turn left, and then move to the first intersection and take another left." Strucker made the left turn on Tanzania Street, but as he approached the intersection, gunfire erupted all around. They weren't more than 80 yards out the back gate. In a Humvee behind Strucker's, Sergeant Rolly Cash screamed, "Action, left!" His turret gunner swung around to face 5 Somalis with weapons, and Cash, who was in the front passenger seat, heard the explosion of gunfire and the zing and pop of rounds passing close. Cash had been taught that if you heard that crack, it meant the bullet had passed near your head. A zing, which sounded to him like the sound made when you hit a telephone pole guy wire with a stick, meant the bullet had missed you by a far margin. The shots were answered by a roaring fusillade. In another of the rear Humvees, reluctant Steve Anderson heard the eruption of gunfire and felt his stomach turn. Then he realized most of what he heard were Ranger guns. Any Somali with a weapon faced a crushing wave of American lead. 50 cals on 3 of the Humvees, saws, and all those M-16s massed on the trucks. Anderson tried to shoot his saw, too, but the weapon jammed. He pulled and pulled on the charging handle, trying to get it unjammed, but it wouldn't budge. So he picked up the driver's M16 and took aim out the back of the moving vehicle. An instant before he took aim, he saw a Somali with a rifle dart through a doorway, but it was too late for him to take a shot. The lead vehicles were taking the brunt of it. An RPG skipped across the top of Strucker's Humvee with a screech of metal on metal and exploded across the street against the concrete wall with a concussion that lifted the wide-bodied vehicle up on two wheels. Then his 50-gunner returned fire to a massed burst of